This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Insofar as the new constitution seeks to give even more power to the head of state or the head of government, for critics of the draft constitution, it represents nothing but a continuation of military rule by other means. It's a repudiation of the ethos of decentralization.
That's Dr. Ebenezer Obadare, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, on Sunday's constitutional referendum in Mali. Details coming up. Also, a high-level African delegation met today with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky. And the UN General Assembly has declared June 17th as World Day. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United States has condemned human rights violations committed in Sudan's two-month-old violence, particularly reports of sexual violence and targeting of civilians along ethnic lines by the paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militias in West Darfur State. Yesterday's statement by the U.S. State Department came a day after West Darfur's state governor, Khamis Abdullah Abakar, was killed, reportedly by RSF soldiers and allied Arab militias. Nabil Biagio reached Saba Salaman, strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association, to discuss the significance of the statement.
I commend the immediate condemnation by the U.S. and some of the U.N. bodies of the horrific and bloody atrocities committed in Sudan and West Darfur, specifically Jenina. I ask the question as to whether the international community is serious about the responsibility to protect innocent civilians from violent war criminals who are, as we speak, continuing to commit these atrocities, continuing to commit ethnic cleansing and what is possibly now genocide. Jenina has been completely wiped out, and residents are currently mass evacuating westward to Chad. The only way to end this war is for a coalition of the U.S., the UN, the AU, and IGAD to work together to enforce and expand the UN arms embargo on Darfur to all of Sudan. There should be serious enforcement of both the U.S. arms embargo as well as the UN arms embargo. That would be the first serious action that they could commit to end this war. The second would be to implement and enforce a no-fly zone. And the third is to continue to freeze the assets and the parastatal companies of the belligerents, both the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces.
Since the start of this conflict in mid-April, the rapid support forces have been accused of many violations against civilians in Khartoum and Darfur and other places, rape, forceful evictions, murder, etc. But there has been this hesitancy from the international community to even some people in Sudan to condemn the acts and put the blame on RSF. How do you read the State Department finally calling out RSF for these violations in West Darfur? And you are someone who meets with the State Department officials at the Sudan desk, and you do work with them. Do you see any shift or any of the measures you said they should take against violators coming into force?
When the U.S. Department of State started to apply the targeted sanctions, they applied those targeted sanctions on both the SAF and the RSF equally. So my reading is that the U.S. administration is putting equal blame on both of these belligerents for fueling this war. And the fact that they have called out the RSF, and they've also called out the SAF for their inability or their lack of willingness to protect Sudanese civilians. I think that the fact that the war has now reached a fever pitch And what is happening in Jenena, in West Darfur, is really now approaching genocide. I think that there's a shift in strategy, and we're going to see a change in tactics from the U.S. administration, where the current approach is no longer feasible, and there has to be a different approach.
That's Sama Salman, strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She spoke with VOA's Nabil Biagio from the U.S. state of Virginia. The UN General Assembly has declared June 17th as World Day to Combat Desertification and Drought with the theme, Her Land, Her Rights. According to the United Nations, women make up around half of agricultural workers in developing countries and produce 60 to 80% of food grown in these regions, yet own less than one-fifth of all land worldwide. When land degrades and water and other resources become scarce, women and girls are exposed to poverty, hunger, displacement, and violence. Undersecretary General and Executive Secretary, UN Convention to Combat Desertification, Ibrahim Thiaw, tells VOA's Lenocht Moudou that women and girls in Africa are critically affected by desertification.
When we say desertification, many people understand it's deserts. No, we are talking about land loss of fertile land. It can be in the middle of a forest or savanna, or it can be in an arid land. But the point is that with the food systems that we have at the moment, we are degrading our land in a very rapid pace. According to our statistics, 1 hectare in 4 from around the world is already lost. And if the statistics continue like this, by 2050, 90% of the all ice-free land in the world will be not necessarily lost, but it will be impacted by human activities. So this is the situation where we would like the world to understand that we have enough land and we can produce enough food to have to live a decent life without necessarily depleting the natural capital upon which we live. We are 8 billion people today in the world. We live on land and we live off land. So it is absolutely critical that we feed the entire community in the world. But we should do it in a way that is compatible with the principles of sustainable development. And we can do it. Now, if we are to achieve that, we have to address the inequalities that we were talking about in terms of women's access to land.
Data show that women make up almost half of the agricultural labor force in developing countries, but they are very limited in terms of access to land rights. Would you share with us the state of women's and access to land?
Only 15% of agricultural land is registered for women in the world, whereas they are actually 45% of the workforce. The reason why we are addressing this issue at the UN Desertification and Drought Day is precisely to put a spotlight on this issue, in addition to being not just, but it is not the right path that we need to take if we are to achieve the sustainable development goals. Essentially, there are very few written laws against women's land rights, but there are a lot of customary laws, a lot of traditions that go against the equality that we are all aspiring at in terms of women's access to land.
What can world leaders do? How can they take urgent action on women's land rights?
But we need more policies to change the situation. The narrative that we talked about is, again, coming from sometimes from customary laws, sometimes from traditions, sometimes wrongly, sometimes attributed to religions. All of that needs to change, and it will change through regulations. It will change through incentives that can be put in place. It can change through programs, specific programs targeting women's access to land. It can change through land restoration programs. When land is degraded and being put back to health, it can be targeted for specific groups to benefit from. And there are multiple initiatives that can be promoted by countries.
Can you talk us through Her Land, Her Rights campaign? What are you hoping to achieve?
Her Land, Her Rights campaign is essentially meant to create the awareness in the world. Most campaigns that have been led so far in terms of gender equality have been addressing either elections, selections, recruitments, positions in governments. These are all very important, but very few have been talking about land and women's access to land, women's land rights. So it is certainly one of the largest campaigns we would like to see, together with our colleagues from the UN Women Organization, the United Nations, with the UN Human Rights Commission, with the Food and Agriculture Organization, with the UN Development Programme. We hope that we will continue to join forces and we will galvanize other actors, including non-state actors, to actually continue this campaign. It's not only one day. The campaign will continue for a full year. And our hope is that it will continue even beyond 12 months.
That's Ibrahim Siaw, Under Secretary General and Executive Secretary, UN Convention to Combat Desertification. He was speaking to VOA's Lenord Moudou from UN headquarters in New York. Young people in South Africa today commemorated Youth Day with a loud call for the government to pay more attention to the many challenges that they face. Many gathered at the Hector Peterson Memorial Center in the Johannesburg township of Soweto. Hector was a 12-year-old who was shot dead on June 16, 1976, one of the first of 20 children who were killed in the youth uprising against the apartheid regime in 1976. 47 years later, the youth say the democratic government has done very little to create an environment conducive for them to excel and live a decent life. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The majority of people who came out to celebrate Youth Day sounded worried and concerned about their future. Dineo Shabangu, a youth from Soweto, told VOA that most youths are frustrated.
We need jobs. It is a must. We need jobs. We need to be balanced in the economy. We need to balance the economy and bring the economy up. So we really need jobs. The government needs to open those factories that they've shut down.
Another youth, Teboho Matebula, is concerned about the increasing rate of other problems.
The thing is about teenage pregnancy, about drug abuse, we don't have anyone who can lead us in the right path as the youth. Rather, the government isn't giving us the recognition that we need.
Buhlale Nkomo from Pretoria blames the lack of quality education for most of the problems faced by young people.
I feel like schools should teach us how to be responsible, how to grow each other, instead of feeding us with knowledge that's just going to be stuck in our heads and it won't be useful because there are less jobs now.
The rate of unemployment amongst the youth aged 15 to 24 years continued to rise. Statistics show that it rose from 61% to 62.1% in 2023. The current average of youth unemployment in South Africa stands at over 55%. In his Youth Day message at the main event held in Free State, Deputy President Paul Mashatile assured the young people that the government was hard at work in a bid to address the triple challenges of unemployment, poverty, and the quality of education. For VOA Africa, I am Tuso Kumalo in Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said after meeting with African leaders in Kyiv today that peace talks with Russia would be possible only after Moscow withdraws its forces from occupied Ukrainian territory. Reuters reports his comments signal no change in Kyiv's long-held stance on peace talks, despite the African delegation's hopes of mediating an end to the war that has raged since Russian forces invaded in February 2022. The African delegation, including leaders of Senegal, Egypt, Zambia, South Africa, and the Comoros, met Zelensky after being greeted in Kyiv by a volley of Russian men. missiles. The delegation headed by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa and Senegalese President Macky Sall is due to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg tomorrow. But what chances do the African leaders have of resolving this conflict in Europe? VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York, and began by asking him what the trip meant.
The trip was delayed, so it had its own challenges, but they're on their way to Ukraine. I must say, Russia has launched missile strikes on Kiev, just as these leaders are getting into Ukraine. So I think that's a warning message from Russia to Ukraine. And it's going to be very difficult for these leaders to actually get a resolution. Firstly, because they are not from the region. They're from another continent. Secondly, because the diplomatic efforts from these African leaders are not backed by the coercive force of military. For any diplomacy to work, you need to have a military hand. So, for example, if you look at the problems we had in the former Yugoslavia, you had the no-fly zone. They had the diplomacy, but the NATO and the military backed up that diplomacy. This is absent in this case. So I think it's a good effort. Any diplomacy is always good. But the problem is there's so many bigger wars in Africa, in Sudan, in the DRC, in South Sudan, you know, that we really have not sorted out. So it's somewhat ironic for African leaders to be going to take care of problems in Ukraine when we have much bigger wars in Africa than even what's going on in Ukraine.
Most African leaders have claimed they are impartial in this conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And some of them have a lot of relationship with Russia from days, colonial days. What do you think prompted them now to embark on this effort?
So that's a good, great question. I think South African foreign policy, particularly the generation of the Thabo Mbekis and Cyril Ramaphosa, these are individuals who have very close relationships with Russia, which used to be the former Soviet Union, and the support that Russia gave the ANC during the dark days of apartheid. So I think a lot of that generation is now in leadership in South Africa, and you really see that coming through. To your earlier question about the challenges of the diplomacy that Ramaphosa is leading, I think Ukraine has tended to see South Africa as being biased in favor of Russia against Ukraine. And I say that because South Africa has maintained close relationships with Russia through the BRICS conference, BRICS organization. But let's also not forget that at the anniversary of this Ukraine war, South Africa welcomed the president of China and a Russian ship into South African ports. So that, even diplomatically, is not a good symbol because it appears that South Africa is biased towards Russia and is not sensitive to the plight of Ukraine. That being said, the historical connections between Ramaphosa and Russia are very strong. Ramaphosa has tended to align South African foreign policy, at least rhetorically, a lot closer with China and Russia. But I think, as I said before, the diplomatic efforts will be very challenging, particularly given the fact that as much as South Africa is a major power on the continent in a global scale, South Africa is still very limited in what it can do outside of the Southern African region.
That was David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. Earlier, he spoke with Douglas Mpuga from New York. 9 people have been arrested in Greece in connection with the sinking of a boat off the country's southern coast Wednesday that killed at least 78 people. The suspects are being held on allegations of people smuggling and participating in a criminal enterprise. While 104 people were rescued, the trawler, which capsized and sank, was believed to have carried as many as 750 people, according to the International Organization Organization for Migration, the UN Migration Agency. The Associated Press reports that 27 of these rescued remain hospitalized. Some of the survivors have been so traumatized that they still believe that they are on the boat and are going to die, according to a Reuters report. And Pope Francis has left a hospital in Rome where he underwent an operation for hernia more than a week ago. Francis left the general hospital in a wheelchair. Asked by well-wishers how he felt, the 86-year-old pontiff said, "Still alive." When he arrived at the Vatican today, he got out of his car to individually thank members of his Italian police escort. The pontiff has suffered a number of maladies since his election, including his problems, hip problems, knee pain, weight gain, and inflamed colon and respiratory infection. While Francis has said he would consider stepping down if his health were to fail him, he has said recently that he has no current plans to quit. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The population of sub-Saharan Africa is projected to double by 2050, according to the United Nations. That poses urgent challenges in terms of food security. In early May, the U.S. State Department's Office of the Special Envoy for Global Food Security organized a panel discussion during the AIM for Climate Summit to discuss the vision for adapted crops and soils, otherwise known as VACS. The initiative, launched in collaboration by the U.S. government, the African Union, and the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, focuses on the development of climate-resilient seeds and improvement of soil health to boost agricultural production. Today, agriculture faces an historically unprecedented combination of challenges, said U.S. Special Envoy for Global Food Security, Carrie Fowler. Building food security really depends on our addressing all of these challenges. The panelists were some of the foremost experts in numerous fields affecting agricultural production, including Professor Linda Majale Sabanda, Chair of CGIAR System Board, Commissioner Joseph Asako from the African Union Commission for Agriculture, Rural Development, Blue Economy, and Sustainable Environment, Dr. Cynthia Rosenzweig from AGMIP and the Columbia Climate School, Lisa Safarian, President and Chief Operating Officer with the agricultural technology company Pivot Bio, and Dr. Robert Reiter, Head of Research and Development in Crop Science at Bayer. Food security depends on addressing the fundamental aspects of having fertile soils and crops adapted to climate change, noted Dr. Fowler. Yet what we find all over the world, and certainly in Africa, are depleted soils. Our crops are not sufficiently prepared for climate change. Our institutions are not sufficiently prepared. We forged a partnership with the African Union and the Food and Agriculture Organization, but also with many others to try to address this particular issue, said Dr. Fowler. Pivot Bio is pursuing a fascinating approach to providing climate-neutral nitrogen to the roots of our crops. Bayer has a very serious analysis of what ails us and is engaged in a wide range of scientific and philanthropic activities. Cynthia Rosenzweig is working with us from NASA and from Columbia Climate School on new climate modeling so we can better understand how the important nutritious crops for Africa will fare in the current and future climates of Africa. Yeah. At the most fundamental level, those challenges in food security really depend on our having fertile soils and depends on having adaptive crops adapted to climate change.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.